Hey, here we are, another edition of Old School Guns. And hey, let me just tell you something really quick. If you like any or all of what you hear on this podcast, please hit the follow button and follow us. That way you'll know when new episodes are basically posted, and you'll also essentially, you know, be the first ones to listen to it. So, hey, hit the follow button and let me know you're out there. I can see how many downloads and listens there are, but I'd like to see how many people routinely listen. That'd be informative for me. And also remember, you can go to my blog, oldschoolguns.com, on Google, and you can always leave comments there, and you can also leave comments on YouTube. I check all those. So anyway, if you want to go ahead and comment, let me know, and if you've got any questions, go ahead and give those to me too, and I'll be happy to address them during the podcast. Okay, hey, we got some great stuff happening. Clearly, just after thinking that the NRA was settling down and everything was returning kind of at least to some semblance of normalcy, the day after I do that podcast, I read where Chris Cox has been suspended. Chris W. Cox, the head of the NRA Institute of Legislative Action, which is the lobbying arm of the NRA. It's kind of a separate for tax and other reasons. It's a kind of a separate but related entity to the main. You know, they do the lobbying on Capitol Hill. They talk to the senators and congressmen. And, you know, I don't know that they really convert anybody. I don't know that any lobbyist does, other than the crooked ones that work for Democratic causes that essentially try to bribe people and everything else. The NRA does not do that. So I don't know if there's anybody ever in the middle of the road who they can kind of influence. But anyway, they're there. They do what they do. But apparently Chris Cox has been suspended and put on administrative leave, which I assume is leave that does not count against your vacation time and you're still getting paid, but you don't have to do anything. That's what I think administrative leave probably means. But he's been taken out. The notional reason is that somehow he was part of the coup attempt against Wayne LaPierre. And this is starting to get ridiculous now. And I've been cutting a lot of slack towards the leadership of the NRA, saying, you know, I know a lot of these guys who are griping now are disgruntled and have had beefs against the NRA for a long time and are using this as an excuse to pile on. But there is a level of weirdness that I'm uncomfortable with how the NRA is doing stuff right now. We still don't know what happened with the Oliver North thing. We don't know if it was an extortion attempt on behalf, or if it was just a suggestion and a talk and trying to get rid of Wayne LaPierre for some questionable behavior that he's exhibited. And, you know, we don't know the reality of this, and I'll get to it in a little bit, but going through my latest American Rifleman magazine, everything is sunshine, lollipops, and roses, and the you know, the new president, they're all talking about how happy everything is. They don't mention anything at all, so of the controversies or anything, and they should put out a statement. We are the members, we pay the bills, and I want to know what's going on there. Not that I'm trying to pick a fight with them. Not that I'm trying to second guess them, but I want to know what's going on. I think we have that right, and it's better to put the info out there than have everybody speculating. So, again, some chicanery there, the gift that keeps on giving. And, you know, they better get this straightened out now. They better get it straightened out now. We have an upcoming election, and we need to be united. We need to be unified, and we need these guys who are the disgruntled, you know, groaners who are always on the sidelines. We need to put them back on the sidelines. We really don't want to give cause for the legit members to listen to them because, you know, the NRA is acting weird. So the members are going to say, well, maybe there's something to these guys. I can tell you by listening to those guys, by doing a little bit of research on them, there's nothing there. They're disgruntled. They've always been on the out. They perceive that there's an in-group, out-group, and there probably is. And this Carolyn Meadows, the new president, is clearly the consummate insider, clearly the kind of person I was talking about on the previous podcasts. I mean, she's on some monument commission, I guess, for Stone Mountain, Georgia, and a few things. You know, you don't just pick somebody who's a receptionist to do that, or somebody like me who gets up and works every day for a living. This is a moneyed, connected person, and that's why they sit on commissions. That's why they have time for all this, you know, these Byzantine politics, like is clearly what's going on in the NRA right now. They're the people who have time for this because they're rich, and when they're not out shooting their $50,000 custom shotguns at an exclusive club somewhere, they're doing this. And the people they're missing, they're completely going over the top of guys like me who get up and go to work every day, maybe get to shoot on a couple of weekends a month, belong to a modest club, do club level competitions, collect guns that are you know, modestly priced, because face it, I don't have the resources to do you know, to amass a giant collection of very expensive firearms. I just don't. So, and I'm perfectly okay with that, and I'm perfectly okay with them doing what they do, but they have to be in touch with who who's the members are. And right now they're more acting like the ruling moneyed FUD elite that they probably are, and they're really not taking care of business. We should be, again, I've articulated this so many times, get rid of the Bush, the H.W. Bush executive order bans. Open up the NFA registration. Take SBRs out of the NFA. Get the Hearing Protection Act so we can have silencers, even though those are kind of in the news now. And reciprocity. And for the second time in a row, I did not mangle that word. So, reciprocity. I mean, those are just no-brainers. Need to be happening. And while we got a Republican president who's notionally friendly to us, we need to get this stuff. And we need to remind him it's still not too late. We can say, look, went along with you with the bump stocks, but now you got to take care of us. And it's more than just saying, hey, I support reciprocity and I support, you know, uniform gun laws and no more gun bans. Okay, that's great that you support that, but we need action and we need to make it happen. And Donald Trump can make things happen. He makes a lot of things happen. So he has got to figure out a way to make this kind of stuff happen. So anyway, that's where we are with the goodness of the NRA. A related story to that is a Parkland survivor has his admission to Harvard revoked. And his name is Kyle Cashews. Sounds like the cashew nut, but it's spelled differently. It's K-A-S-H-U-Z. I guess that's Cashews or Cashews. I haven't really been following this guy. I kind of did see he kind of was the conservative voice who said, hey, this is not a gun problem. This is a bunch of other problems. And he's right. He's a good kid, and it's right. So somehow, Harvard, why you'd want to go to school there anyway, just, I don't know, but maybe he'll get to a better school now. But Harvard basically decided that they were going to revoke his admission based on some social media posts where apparently some racist language or abusive language was used. And it was done by, you know, the young man even said, hey, I was a 16-year-old kid, I was trying to be over the top, and I said stupid things. And he apologized for it. That should be good enough for everybody. And I think that this even kind of made the national news. Of course, on the internet news with PMS, NBC, and the rest of these people, the picture of him is he's got some NRA background, you know, he's standing in front of a screen that's got the NRA logos all over it. So I guess he spoke at an NRA event or at the annual meetings or something. But anyway, it's a good kid. And, you know, let me just say that if you looked at all the social media posts of all the kids who were getting into Harvard and you applied this same standard, guess what? You wouldn't have very many freshmen at Harvard. This is part of the social insanity that we're going through in this country, and that is, somebody says something on social media, and then 5 years later, they're drudging it up, or dredging it up. I guess drudge is something else, but they're dredging it up to use against them. And I'm at the point where it's like, first of all, who cares? First of all, if you're going through somebody's Instagram account or whatever kind of social media deal, if you're going through years of a guy's posts, you need to get a life. You need to get a better life. You need to really get a better life for yourself, because you're a loser. You're a freaking loser. And, you know, it's all this stuff. They did that to a comedian, a couple, you know, the guy who's going to host the Oscars. I forget his name, but, you know, he's a pretty funny comedian, but he made some anti-gay posts in like 2008. And somehow, it's a problem in 2018. And you know what the answer is? It's not. It's, you have to let some of that go. And when a person apologizes and says, no, I really didn't mean that, or, you know, back then my views really were different, and since then I've come to other views. Every one of us has had views like that that have changed. And, you know, we need to start as a society forgiving ourselves rather than dredging this stuff up. So I really think that this kid deserves a break. If he wants to go to Harvard, he should be allowed to go. He's apologized. You know, and unfortunately, this is going to follow him around for a while until people just don't care anymore. And I mean, I think most people don't care now. Most people don't care now. And if Harvard were really an enlightened institution, if Harvard was really the bastion of goodness that they pretend to be, if Harvard was anything than just a Democrat nest, a hive of hypocrites, if it was anything other than that, they should say, we want this kid to come here because we want to help him be on the straight and narrow, and we want to expand his education so that the thinking and ideas he expressed as a 16-year-old, he would really, you know, we'd really reinforce the error of his ways. But of course they don't. It's all politically motivated, and they don't want free speech there. They're a Soviet propaganda brainwashing machine, and that's what most universities have become. They're trash. They're garbage. You know, I'll be honest with you. I had to take some classes for a master's degree, and holy cow, you know. The technical classes where you're just talking about your subject, hey, that's great. But boy, they put some interpersonal communications, and it's all a bunch of bunk, claptrap, libthink, tardthink. That's all this class was. And you know what you do? You regurgitate it back to them, so you get an A, you walk away, and then you basically, you know, your last day of the class, you walk out of the room, you flip the bird and get on with your life. Because what they're trying to do is brainwash and trash teach and everything else. There's trash talking and there's trash teaching. And unfortunately, trash teaching is really pretty predominant nowadays. So we're kind of looking around here. Got my American Rifleman in the mail. And of course, it had a nice precision Ruger rifle on the cover. I don't really shoot PRS. I can tell you this though, and I don't know about this Ruger, but I've got a Savage that's PRS-y. It's not really exactly a PRS rifle, but it's like that. And I tell you, with these newer cartridges for long range shooting, you better have interchangeable barrels. You better have interchangeable barrels or some way to interchange a barrel like the Savage does, because you'll be learning an expensive lesson if you don't. Finding a gunsmith who will swap out a barrel is, you know, that's a lot harder than you think. A friend of mine hunted in Africa. And to practice up before he went to Africa, for about a year, he shot all kinds of rounds out of his 300 Magnum. He was going after some plains game, you know. Got some strange-looking antelope things with weird horns on it, whatever. So he goes after that. And in the course, he shoots a lot out of a Browning 300 Magnum. Beautiful gun, by the way. And in the course of, after coming back from Africa, he still shoots it and is getting ready for deer season several years later after, you know, kind of routinely shooting the gun. And he detects a noticeable loss in accuracy. And lo and behold, of course, he'd shot out the barrel, basically eroded the throat and the first part of the rifling, so the bullet isn't exiting the barrel as stable as it should be. Probably a lot of wear on the muzzle and crown, you know. Probably a lot of muzzle wear, too. Muzzle erosion. So anyway, he has to have it rebarreled, and that was such a fiasco, finding someone just to rebarrel something, and it is not cheap. And it kind of made a savage rifle guy out of him, because, hey, you can buy the tools and you can switch out a barrel yourself with, you know, if you have a modicum of skill, if you're completely all thumbs. I'm just barely above completely all thumbs, so I could probably do it. It's not a sure bet. I mean, I wouldn't bet the ranch on this, but I could probably do it. And so, and I'm pretty much thumbs, and I'm impatient. I'm just terrible with stuff like this. I explained to you, it's a miracle that I could reload the 577-450 Martini Henry round. So that is actually an inspired miracle, and they should send a priest from the Vatican to investigate that. That is how big of a miracle that is. But getting back to it, the Ruger looks like a very nice gun, but the American Rifleman is really, this was an addition. It really showed how much the magazine has changed and evolved over the years to meet shooters' tastes. And when you look at the opening it up here, we just look at the featured articles. And, okay, we got to save the Second Amendment in the courts. Okay, that's by Chris W. Cox, who may not be a player anymore. Racing for Firearms Freedom in Indianapolis. That is a whitewash of what actually happened, but, you know, that's a good thing. Then we have the Ruger's New Leaf, the Hawkeye Goes Long. That's the Model 77 Hawkeye. That's the PRS gun on the cover. And then we have Model 1941 Johnson Rifle in Marine Service by Bruce N. Canfield, the greatest military rifle author of all time. Bruce Canfield is a gift to us. And if you don't have his books are just awesome. And if you're going to collect any kind of military guns, and he covers a lot of the accoutrements, you know, the stuff that goes along with them, the slings and the bayonets and ammo pouches and other little things, all the little bits that go along with it. He also includes a lot of that also, and a lot of the rarer variations. And wipe that out. Rarer variations of some of these different guns. So a lot of them you won't even know existed, you know, where they may have bought several thousand, you know, shotguns and made riot guns out of them, you know, just because they were available off the shelf. He covers all that. So it's really great. The 1941 was kind of used by the Marines a little bit. Was never really, it was kind of a backup. Might have been used had the Garand proved out for some technical reason to be a complete failure. They could have gone to the Johnson. It was a good, but really not a, it, just a design that's just stayed in the background, because the greatness of the Garand is, you know, is a marvelous, inspired design, and it really, really did well. Then it's guns from Big Green, the RP9 and RP45. Again, Remington must be on crack. Why would you, as a rifle manufacturer, introduce polymer-framed 9mm, and I guess a 45 too? Why would you get into that market? It kind of goes back to what I was saying about Hudson Arms. I mean, why would you try to introduce something into a market that's full of quality guns that have got decades of developmental time behind them? You know, what's going to make you compete? Is this going to make you compete with Glock? Really? I don't think so. And face it, Glocks are not that expensive. There's Steyrs, there's Walthers, there's, there's other ones that I'm even forgetting. Heckler & Koch, you know. Heckler & Koch. There's all these guns out there. And now they jam these in. And frankly, Remington does not have a big handgun name. I mean, their 1911 is out there, and it's okay. And that was actually pretty smart, because anybody who can make a 1911 should do so, because they sell well. And if you can make them reasonably priced, they're even better. People like them. I like them. I think the 1911 is one of the great pistol designs ever. As far as shootability and you know, power, accuracy, and the way it feels in your hand, the 1911 is awesome. The RP45, who knows? And they got pictures of these things. And, you know, frankly, I can't tell half these guns apart. You know, when you used to, in the old days, when you saw a Smith & Wesson Model 39, you knew exactly what it was. A Browning High Power, you knew exactly what it was. All these polymer frame guns all look the same because the design is essentially the same. It's not bad. They're not bad designs. They're good designs. But they're all functionally the same. So if you're going to get in that market, you better offer some. What's my reason to buy it? What are you offering? What is my, why would I buy this? And so, you know, that's another thing with Remington. And then we go to the great article, the last of the breed, the Marine Corps M45A1. And that is the last of the U.S. military 1911s. It was carried by the Marines. It looks like carried by their special operations folks. Our special Army special operations guys carried some in Iraq too. Good guy I work with. He carried one. I was always an M9er, so I carried the M9 for about probably maybe 2/3 of my, well, more about half of my, just over half of my career. I was lucky. I was in a place where we had 1911s until like 1994. So we didn't have to give. And once I did start shooting the M9, I really liked it. As a matter of fact, I think it's a great gun, and it's actually one of my favorite 9mm, one of my favorites. I still also like the CZ-75 and the Walther P-38, and there's other ones. But Browning High Power has always been a favorite of mine. They always fit the hand so well. But anyway, Marine Corps. But this is how, you know, it used to be that when you opened up the American Rifleman, you would have seen FUD articles. And there really doesn't look to be a single one in here, you know. I mean, and I guess doing, 100 years of white-tailed deer articles is probably enough for a while. If you go underneath the dope bag, they're covering a few hunting rifles. But even the hand loads, they're covering 7.62x39 Russian. And for I have this old gun, it's the 1866 Winchester, which, you know, is a great gun on the frontier, and actually a great, if you can find one these days, a great collector's item. And it's such a good gun that the reproductions are used in cowboy action shooting. And I really like them because I don't shoot cast, but I really like those reproductions. They're beautiful guns. The Yellow Boys, they're absolutely beautiful. When they start getting the aged patina on them, they really look sharp. They look like they just fell off a stagecoach and from the Old West. So, yeah, the American Rifleman has changed. And you know what? I like it a lot better now. I just am not the FUD guns. Even though I own a bunch, well, not a bunch, but I own a few that I've inherited, and I keep them for sentimental values. You know, how do you sell your father's deer rifle that he loved? You know, you don't. Or how do I sell the deer rifle my brother gave me? You don't sell those. So, you know, some people can. Some people don't attach anything to them, and there are guns like that for sale all the time. But I cannot, so I keep them. So if anybody looked at my small little gun safe and in my collection of guns, they would say, "Oh, you must be a great hunter, you know. You do a lot of hunting, don't you?" The answer is no, I don't. And in fact, it's probably been, you can probably measure in years, the last time I fired the Remington 780L, that top dollar, top performer that I have sitting there with a whopping, it's got a loophole scope, which is good. It's like a 2-7. You know, it's a good piece of kit, and it does exactly what it's supposed to for hunting. You know, you kill a deer, you probably kill a deer at 250, 300 yards with that. The 308's a great round, but I just don't hunt, so therefore I don't really use it, and it's not really a great range gun because it's comparatively light. heavy recoil, not and just not, you know, FNFAL, a lot more interesting to me. So let's go to my favorite part of the show, which is Q&A. I just love this because I just love the questions can sometimes be very amusing, but my answers are probably even more amusing, and that's the people laughing at me maybe and not with me. But here we go. Here's the first one. How much more advanced are modern ARs over the retro ARs, and will I be disappointed if I buy a retro AR? Well, it all depends what disappointed means. I love retro ARs. I think they're better than the modern ones, to be blunt. The reason is they're sleeker, they're lighter, they're less complicated. They don't have all the doodads and junk, you know. You don't have to worry about rails and all that. I really like them. I've always liked them. And I hate to say that, but the first ARs I bought are now considered retro ARs. I like the A1 style. I mean, I really do. Or the, you know, the AR-15 SP1 style. And you can get kind of these guns from Brownells. They do a great job. You can even get the early prototype that has the trigger charging handle on top. What a fun gun to have. What a really great opportunity to own a gun that most people have only seen in books. And even then, there's not a lot of pictures or a lot of descriptions of it. So what a fun gun to have. But I basically say that, first of all, if you don't understand, it depends what kind of track shooting you're doing. And I explained this in the last podcast. If you don't understand twist rates and bullet weights and twist rates, yeah, that's it. If you don't understand that, you are in for a very expensive lesson. You are in for a very expensive lesson in ARs. And match the gun to the type of shooting you want to do. If it's just general shooting, and even self-defense and a few things, a retro AR is a great gun. The lightweight barrel, everything that made that a great rifle is still valid today. You know, the same thing can be said for the M1 Garand. You know, just because there are more modern designs does not mean that the Garand's performance is degraded at all. It, you know, and the ARs are the same way. They will hit a target. I mean, they can. Granted, there's a lot of stories. If you yank on the sling in a super tight sling, you can change a point of impact. Well, the fact of the matter is you can change point of impact even just by by somebody knocking your scope or knocking your red dot. You can have a change of point of impact by just the way the sun shines on iron sights. So a lot of that is kind of hype overblown. And unless you're shooting matches, you're probably not even going to notice it. But if you're shooting out to 300 yards and even 400, and I would say that you could probably shoot man-sized targets 500 yards with a retro AR, you know, those steel silhouette type targets that are shaped like a military E silhouette. I'm sure you can spank one with a retro AR. Have a lot of fun. You have a lightweight, cool, historical gun. You can get from Brownells or even cheaper from Midway copies of the Colt 3 and 4 power scopes. You know, they're compared to scopes nowadays, they are crappy. They are crappy. But they are good. You know, you just put them on there, tighten a little nut through the charging handle. You just tighten them up and sight them in, and they're good to go. They will give you that single focal plane that you can look through, and you basically just put the crosshairs on the target, and they're very cool, very compact, very cool, and you can do a lot of great general shooting with that. You know, is it an EOTech? No. Is it a, you know, aim point or any of the SCADs of 1-8, 1-6, 1-10 scopes? And everybody's arguing on what the best AR optic is. And if you really want optics on an AR, you got to go with a flat top anyway, so you can pop these things on and off. But for a carry handle, you can pop something on there. And they actually even have the old gooseneck mounting system that kind of it goes into the mounting handle, but it puts a rail out forward of it, and you can put something on there and co-witness the sights and do all that. If you're going to do all that, I'd go with a flat top and say, hey, I'm just going to enjoy life, shoot my flat top, and have fun. And I've got an AR like that, a more modern AR, and it's a lot of fun. But the retro guns, especially with the duck bill suppressors and all that, they're a lot of fun. So if you want a gun for fun, and that's going to be fun to show people, different from a lot of the other ARs on the range, and different in a way where you're not competing with who's got the latest baubles and who's got the coolest rail system and all this other junk that comes along. If you want a gun that's going to be a little bit different and be unique, then I think the retro ARs are perfect. They're great guns, and you will really, really like them. So that's how I put it. You will not be disappointed. If you're looking for maximum performance, ease of mounting optics, and modularity and interchangeability and all the rest of that, buy a modern AR and then, you know, get it. Start doing research on the internet and start buying all the junk that bolts on it that improves it. And then there you go. Okay, 6.5 by 55. Is modern ammo safe in Norwegian crags? And I know the answer to this because I have shot Norwegian crags. Okay, modern ammo is really, there's modern hunting ammo out there that's like $50 a box. That's not really what I'm looking for a Norwegian crag. Norwegian crags, I'm usually shooting like PPU, so this is the kind of ammo I have experience with. The Norwegian crag, 6.5 by 55, not known to be tremendously accurate, but it's a fun gun to shoot. My experiences with a 1912/16, which is one of the later ones, and it's perfectly fine with modern ammunition. I have read, but I do not know firsthand, that the earlier 1894 model crags, because of the single locking lug of the crag system, that they are not safe with modern ammo, or not as safe with modern ammo. So you're taking a little bit of you have an increased risk because of the metallurgy was probably a little bit different, and so it's not as good as the later model crags. Now, the U.S. Krag, you'd think, well, it's got the same weaknesses as the U.S. Krag. Now, U.S. Krag, the bolt handle actually kind of goes into that little recess, which is part of the receiver when it's in the down locked position. So it acts as another safety lug. The Norwegian does not have that. So U.S. Krags have an extra amount of safety, a little extra safety there. But I think you should be fine. Frankly, I don't know. I've never seen anyone shoot a Model 94 Norwegian Krag, and I've seen precious few 1912, 1916 Krags. I imagine you would overseas, but you don't see them here. But yes, indeed, they are safe with the PPU ammo, at least the PPU ammo I tried. Okay, Kel-Tec, Desertec, Tavor all produce 7.62x51 NATO bullpup battle rifles. Are they as good as other 7.62 NATO battle rifles? Okay. Here's what I will say, and this will make everybody mad. This is guaranteed. To make everybody mad. Okay, what I will tell you is that unless a battle rifle has been adopted and has sufficient development behind it, unless it's been adopted by any kind of a military power, right, I guess, it is a range toy, and it is not something that you should bet your life on. Now, does it mean that it's a bad weapon? No. Does it mean anything other than it hasn't been adopted, and it probably has not had the rigors of military testing? And face it, no manufacturer is going to test their gun the way a prospective military would if they're looking at adoption. So while those guns may be cool, while those guns may work fine on YouTube, and if you want to buy one for match use or whatever else, and guns are supposed to be fun. So if you want to buy one for fun because it's unique and different, okay. Personally, I'd rather have an FNFAL or an FAL. I would much rather have any number of things in 7.62 NATO. And, you know, I'm talking about the M14 clones, the BM59 clones. They're out there, and they're significantly less expensive. But although they are not true military weapons, because they're not really, although I would say DSA has produced military FALs for anti-poacher units and other things, but the ones made by JRA, for instance, or Fulton Armory, have not really been adopted by any military. So they're not strictly military weapons, but the design is, and the design's proven, and the development that went into the design and corrected things like, well, after a certain number of times, this part breaks, so therefore it has to be designed slightly differently, and all this. That's really where you make money on a rifle. You know, it has that extra development in there. And the AR-15 and AKs are examples of that. You know, they incrementally change them to try to improve them. And some of the improvements work out, some don't. I would say that the M16A2 was a step in a different direction from what the ARs were supposed to be. And as Kalashnikov would have said, the AK-74 is a step in a different direction from what the AK was supposed to be. So, you know, but this incremental improvement, the design of certain internal parts, the whatever the specification is for hardening or of parts and things, they, you know, they kind of work all that out. And if somebody's making a good clone, they've either got former surplus military parts they're using, or they've got newly made parts that they're kind of clued in on what needs to be done to those to keep them well. But you'll find a great level of reliability in the former military designs. And so that's why I don't really think those are as good as military adopted rifles. Now, ones that are tweeners would be like Brownell's AR-10. You could say, well, the AR-10 was only kind of sold to a few people. It was developed a little bit. The Brownell's one isn't exactly, because they've had to use some more modern parts and things. But I would say that generally, that I would trust that more. Would I trust it as much as some of the other ones? I don't know. I'd get it and see. I mean, I certainly would keep an open mind. But I'm not a bullpup fan anyway. They're very hard to clear jams out of. They look cool, and I don't really like having the firing mechanism that close to my face either. I don't. Not that the other ones are any more safe, I suppose, if the chamber detonated, but just having it right next to me, I'm just not comfortable with it, so therefore I don't really look at those. Okay, which is better, meaning which do I prefer, because I can't determine which is better, a Colt Diamondback or a Smith & Wesson K-15 Masterpiece? Ooh, two classic, very, very classic revolvers. Dating from that, I think the Diamondback came out 66, 67, right around there. The K-15, probably about the same time. Maybe that was late 50s. K-15 was the combat masterpiece, and it was adopted by the U.S. Air Force as the M-15, used by the security police. The Diamondback was never adopted by military service, but it saw widespread police use. So, even the movie Brannigan with John Wayne, he carries a Colt Diamondback. So, both very, very good guns. I have to say I prefer the Colt for looks. I prefer the Smith & Wesson lockwork, but they both have great trigger pulls. The Colt I like a little bit because the heavy barrel and that big underlug, full barrel underlug it has. It's like a python. Looks like a little miniature Colt Python. That works for me. That really works. And the K-15 does not have that. So I have to say that works for me personally. So I'd probably tip the scales for the Diamondback. But the M-15 is a fine, fine revolver. And it probably sells for about two-thirds of what a Diamondback sells for. I think Diamondbacks now are ridiculous. They're going for probably $1,500. So, anyway, I'm pretty sure you can get a M15 less than that. And the M15 is the good tried and true K-frame. You know, same thing the Model 10 is, only it's got better sights and usually a little better finish and, you know, a few little enhancements here and there, but it's essentially the same as the basic K-frame Model 10, which is, you know, absolutely a fantastic weapon. Okay, what does RHKP mean on my Colt Police Positive revolver? And that's located on the back strap. What that means is, and that's a good thing to have on there. If you like interesting guns with an interesting history, that means Royal Hong Kong Police. And that was the British-administered police force in Hong Kong when Hong Kong was a crown colony. And, you know, they ceased to exist in 1997 or whenever the British gave it back. Not a very bright thing to do, but probably didn't have any choice. Anyway, but those guns hit the surplus market in little quantities here and there. You get Model 10s, Colt Police Positives. All these things go back. I don't think I've ever seen a pre-World War II example marked like this. And I'll say that because they were probably using some sort of Webley at that point. Up until after World War II, probably the 1950s, they started buying American revolvers and marking them. But it's a very, very cool marking to have when you think about the intrigue of Hong Kong and, you know, characters like Peter Lorre wandering around and, you know, kind of spying and all of that, you know, kind of cloak and dagger stuff. And I really think that's a very, very cool marking to have on a revolver. And so if you see one, I don't know that it adds a lot of value, but I would snap it up. Yeah, I'd snap it up. But I don't know that I'd pay a huge premium. I'd probably pay something extra for it, but probably not a huge amount. I think if you go on GunBroker, you can still find them here and there. You might have to be patient. And if I remember right, a lot of them came out in I think the Smith & Wessons I've seen are 38 Special, and most of the other ones are in 38 Smith & Wesson, the British 38-200, you know, the stubbier, little bit larger tapered cartridge, just like the Victory models. The U.S. ones were 38 Special, and the other ones were 38 Smith & Wesson, the different caliber that confuses a lot of people, and they are not interchangeable. So, I think the Colts I've seen are 38 Smith & Wesson, and the Smith revolvers are 38 Special. Oh, and this is easy. Was the 38 Special used as a military cartridge? Well, we said in a previous question that the Air Force adopted the Smith & Wesson combat masterpiece as the M15. So, right there, it was. And their security police used it. The Army used it, and the Navy used it also. You'll find World War II pilots were routinely armed with Smith & Wesson Victory models, which was the K-frame model with a Parkerized finish. And I think it had a V serial number. And later on, they went to VS when they made some change to it, make it a little safer. I think so you could drop it and it wouldn't necessarily go off. Maybe a rebounding hammer or something. But anyway, you can find a lot of World War II Smith & Wesson 38 Special revolvers. I've seen them marked U.S. Navy are the most prolific because, you know, we had a lot of aircraft carriers. We had a lot of guys flying Navy planes, both from shore and from the aircraft carriers. So a lot of them were marked U.S. Navy. The other one is the Colt Commando, which was the Colt official police. not the police positive, but the official police, the larger, you know, the Colt duty, police duty gun of the 1920s and 30s. And that had a parkerized finish, and that was called the Colt Commando, and they large numbers of those were procured. You know, the assembly lines were already set up for these guns, so all they had to do was apply a different finish, change the markings a little bit, and voila, there you go. And those were not necessarily used tremendously by the military, but they were used for a lot of you know, police, you know, could get them. You know, if you were police in the continental United States during World War II, you know, you just couldn't go out and buy weapons. All the production was spoken for, so you kind of had to go through the War Department and get these things. And a lot of defense plants, you know, had Colt Commandos for their security guards and all that. And I believe it's Canfield's book, which states that Dwight D. Eisenhower had a Colt Commando. That was kind of what he used as a personal sidearm. So there you go. That's pretty heavy use. Now, you will find Smith & Wesson Victory models in 38 Smith & Wesson, what we were talking about a little earlier with the Hong Kong police, the shorter, stubbier cartridge. That was adopted by the British and by extension, the Commonwealth. And so thousands of those were made and given to the British and Australians and probably some others. And those came back surplus in the 80s and 90s, and they were selling super cheap, man. They were selling super cheap. I remember those things going for like $89, $90, and you could buy them all day long, you know. And guys bought them. They're a lot more expensive now. That's one of those guns that doesn't seem like anybody would really want it, but you know, you buy it, you hold on to it, and all of a sudden, when World War II becomes a big thing like it is now, even a modest World War II surplus gun can bring some money. And so it appreciates, so it, you know, maybe it sells for four times what it did then. That's still not a lot of money. You can probably still buy one of those for under, I'm just guessing, under $500. And that's not a lot compared to a lot of World War, you know, certainly you try to buy a 1911 A1, and that's going to be a lot more expensive. So this is a way you can get a piece of World War II armament history without, for a lot less money. So, yeah, the 38 Special, they were used up through, and they used these things, the 38 Special was used up through the 80s and probably into the 90s. They got rid of them probably in the 90s. I remember seeing one in an arms room in Germany, and it was marked U.S. Navy, and it was a U.S. Army arms room. But it was marked U.S. Navy, and it was used by the commanding officer's driver. He was, because of the unit we were in, he was actually authorized, what we would call a PSD now, personal security detail, authorized. We called it in those days a bodyguard. He said, my driver can do that, the guy who drove his Jeep. And so this guy carried around a 38 Special U.S. Navy marked Victory model Smith & Wesson. not much protection there, really. I mean, they probably would have been a lot better off handing him a magazine for his M16A1, and when we were over there, they switched to the M16A2. So he probably would have been better off. It probably would have been a much better deal to give him some rounds for his long arm instead of this ridiculous, you know, kind of a pistol. And when everybody else around him has got M16s, but we have no ammo, you know. That's kind of the way the military works. Kind of works in a very odd way. So you get those, and there was a lot of. You don't see too much of its surplus, but there was 38 Special full metal jacket military ammo, and you know what? And I've seen some commercial copies of that. I don't know why anybody'd want it. I mean, they sell it kind of cheap. I guess that's the only reason. And you really can't buy factory wad cutters target ammo anymore, so I guess this is like the bottom end 38 Special ammo. But yeah, you see that 130 grain FMJ, and that's exactly what the military used. So it wasn't like it had a great hollow point round or anything else. It had the FMJ rounds. You can still find interesting holsters for those. The Colt Commando and the Smith would basically, you could use the same holster for each of them. And they had MP holsters, you know, they were kind of black. And then the Aviators carried a kind of a russet colored, and I'm talking Army helicopter pilots, carried kind of a russet colored shoulder holster. And they had their Smith & Wesson revolvers in that. So Aviators carry them. I'm very positive that all of that is long gone. I mean, they've put those away. And who knows, maybe someday the CMP will get some of those. You know, they're getting some 1911s, so maybe someday we'll get the Smith & Wesson Victory models and Colt Commandos and whatever kind of odd revolvers that the services turned in. I think the Air Force also used some Ruger revolvers, so there could be, you know, what they're holding, you know, there could be a kind of a neat mishmash of late 20th century revolvers still in military stores somewhere, and hopefully those will be surplused. Anyway, that's basically it for old school guns, and what I'd like to tell you is, reiterate what I said at the top of the show, go ahead and hit the follow button for us so we can see you kind of out there. Just like to know the numbers, and you'll get advanced notice when a new episode is put up. So anyway, this is Old School Guns out.